This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
President Biden signed an executive order Friday establishing a commission to study whether to add seats to the Supreme Court. The White House announced fulfilling a promise he made on the campaign trail. The commission will be chaired by former White House counsel Bob Bauer and Christina Rodriguez.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the future of that third branch of government, the Supreme Court. During the last campaign season, we heard Democrats proposing the idea that we need to add some more members to the Supreme Court. And again, I just want to pause this thought for just a second. I go back to the elections. When Donald Trump was being elected, I think one of the reasons that, and it was close between him and Hillary initially in that race, I think the Supreme Court, and knowing that there would be several particular possible nominations, a lot of people looked at the issue. They looked at the issue of life. I mean, you saw what Donald Trump did in terms of pro-life justices. You know, I mean, clearly he had the ability to place to fill those seats. During this election, this last election between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, I don't think the Supreme Court was a big issue. I don't think people were as passionate. We saw what the president did. There was some talk that if Joe Biden was elected, you know, would it be possible that they would, would he be open to packing the court or expanding it? It's not an unconstitutional idea. It's not. The Constitution didn't fix a number of judges to sit on the Supreme Court, and they left it to Congress to establish, the lower courts. So it's perfectly okay for Congress to decide how many people will sit on the highest court of the land. But you're hearing justices and you're hearing a lot of experts saying, hey, we like the number nine, right? This could get out of control if, let's say, the Dems pack and then the Republicans take over office and then they add. I mean, where does it end? And maybe you're nervous. You know, maybe you're nervous that that's what's going to happen. Maybe you're concerned about the impact of Supreme Court packing. Check this report out from NBC News. They're going to tell you about Justice Breyer, who was warning against court packing. Listen.
Well, the message is as interesting as the messenger, who is Stephen Breyer, the oldest member of the U.S. Supreme Court. And he is basically a warning against trying to put more justices on the court. As you may know, many Democrats have said that more Supreme Court justices should be added to counteract the conservative lean of the court because of President Trump's three nominees. President Biden has been somewhat cool to this, saying he's not a fan of court packing. But Justice Breyer says the reason the Supreme Court is something that is trusted in American life is that it's not viewed as political. He says, and this is a favorite subject of his, why do people obey Supreme Court decisions? The lower courts have to, but why does the public accept them, given that the court doesn't have any power to spend money, it doesn't have a military to enforce its rulings? And he says it's because the court has for decades built up public trust, and he says that would be jeopardized if the court is seen as merely political, which he fears would be the outcome if more justices are added just to change the ideological makeup of the court.
And I do think that's a valid point. I do think that the court is perhaps the most trusted, branch of government. And so you have Justice Breyer warning against packing the court. You've got members of Congress starting to advocate for more members to be on it for reasons other than, for instance, an increase in population in the country. When that happens, then you need to consider, why are they doing that? Is it political? Why are they calling for this? Is it justified? What's the reason behind it? I don't know if you know the history behind this. Back in 1930, when Franklin D. Roosevelt, he couldn't get his way with a number of bills that he was passing in response to the Great Depression. All of the public works bills, they were coming at taxpayer expense, and they were being challenged in court, and the Supreme Court was ruling against the bill. So FDR, he threatened to pack the court. That's what he did. He said, I'm going to add to the number of its members so he could get his way. That's pretty much the bottom line here. And the threat worked. The court started finding in favor of those bills. Now, maybe some would argue against that, but just take a look at that history. The the court size has been at 9 since the beginning of the 20th century, and it seems to have worked out pretty well. But because it now has a majority of conservative members, the Democrats aren't happy. In response, the President Biden, instituted a commission last Friday that will be looking at a number of, let's say, court reforms, including adding to the number, along with looking at other issues for lifetime appointments of the justices. I don't know where you are on this and how you feel about it. Is this a good thing to do? Is there any harm in this exploratory effort? Did you know, though, and the president, when he was pressed on this, when he was running for office, are you going to pack the court? And he would not answer that question. So they dug back and they found some audio from C-SPAN. And here's what President Biden said back in the early 1980s.
The president has the authority to do it. Just if I can make an analogy that's not totally appropriate, but to talk about perceptions for a moment, speak of perceptions and why I think they're so important. President Roosevelt clearly had the right to send to the United States Senate and the United States Congress a proposal to pack the court. It was totally within his right to do that. He violated no law. He was legalistically absolutely correct. But it was a bonehead idea. It was a terrible, terrible mistake to make. And it put in question, for an entire decade, the independence of the most significant body, including the Congress, in my view, the most significant body in this country, the Supreme Court of the United States of America. The president had the right to do that. He was totally within his power, and his objective was seen clearly. Well, the president clearly has the right to do what he's doing, in my view. It's clear on the face what he's attempting to do. But the fact of the matter is, it is about the worst thing we could do at a time when the problems of the disenfranchised in this country, primarily black and Hispanic Americans, are being put in serious jeopardy because of legislation, because of changing economic conditions.
All right, again, that was the 1980s when Joe Biden had said that. He is today the president, and as I mentioned, there is this exploratory effort to look at the Supreme Court. And again, you can join us, 888-914-9149, and sound off. I'd like to talk today, though, with Mark Chenoweth. He is the executive director and general counsel of the new Civil Liberties Alliance. And you can check that organization out at their initials, nclalegal.org. That's nclalegal.org. Hey, good to have you back, Mark. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Your view on this. I mean, there are a lot of people who are very concerned about the thought of the court being packed. Some are saying, hey, look, we're just exploring the idea right now. Any harm in what's now happening, or do you think this is a precursor to ultimately adding members to the Supreme Court? And if it is indeed, then what are the practical steps it would entail?
Well, I do think it's very harmful, Drew. I think it's deliberately intended to be harmful. It's intended to be a shot across the bow and to influence the deliberations of the court, including Chief Justice Roberts, who has shown a certain propensity to bend to this sort of external pressure in the past. And I'm afraid that that is the point of the convening of this new committee, regardless of what recommendations they might make in the end. But I did want to, listening to the intro there, I did want to maybe take issue with one thing, if it's okay with you.
Sure, no, go ahead.
I'm not sure I agree that Congress has the power to increase the number of justices of the Supreme Court. Article 1, Section 8 gives Congress limited powers. One of those powers is the power to, quote, constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, unquote. Mm-hmm. Right. So under the limited powers of Article 1, Section 8, Congress does not have the ability to constitute the Supreme Court, only the inferior tribunals. And then you might say, well, how did they do it in the first place? We can get into that. I think the Necessary and Proper Clause has something to do with that in a way at the beginning that wouldn't be true today.
Well, explain that in greater detail, because my understanding is that the Constitution didn't fix a number of judges, and it has changed in the past. So how does that number change? Maybe give us a little history lesson here. When did it change? What fomented that change? And, you know, what would have to happen to see the court either expand or shrink? And constitutionally, what is needed to meet that criteria?
So originally it was six, and I think that they figured out pretty quickly under George Washington that having an even number of justices wasn't such a good idea. So it jumped to seven. And then there was an effort early on during the Andrew Jackson years to change the number, but the big change came around the time of the Civil War when Andrew Johnson was president, and you had obviously right after Lincoln was assassinated, you had a Democrat vice president in Johnson who became the president. The Republicans still controlled both houses of Congress. They didn't want President Johnson to make appointments, so they prevented that temporarily, and then restored that when Ulysses Grant became the president. But we've had nine justices since the time of Ulysses Grant. You mentioned increasing with the growth and the size of the country, and that's what happened when we increased from seven to nine. And I should have that exact year, but I don't have it in front of me. But that was as a result of growth in the population of the country, and the justices themselves were asking for that increase, because you may remember that justices used to do what's called writing circuit. They would go around the country and hear cases, and that was hard to do as the country got bigger.
So what are the issues right now? I've heard some people say, hey, why is everybody getting upset? This is exploratory. What are the issues of the commission that President Biden set up? What are they going to look at besides just adding members, term limits, et cetera? But, what are they examining? What is problematic? What might come from it?
Well, none of those things are constitutional, right? So term limits would be directly contrary to Article 3 of the Constitution and would require a constitutional amendment. So if anything that they're coming up with is to propose a constitutional amendment, then that would be the legal way that you would have to do it. If they're trying to propose something short of a constitutional amendment, then I'm going to be pretty concerned that they are trying to do an end run around the Constitution. And I think that any efforts in that direction will really compromise the independence of the judiciary. In terms of things that are being proposed, it's, as you say, they're talking about potentially adding justices. They're talking about term limits. I've seen a whole lot of different ideas thrown around, including say, having a fixed number of years for a justice that can't be renewed. So, for example, each justice would have an 18-year term or something like that, where it would be long but not lifetime. But again, all those things would require constitutional amendment, because there's a lot of steps in the Constitution to protect the independence of the judiciary. It's not just the lifetime tenure. It's not just the inability to reduce the salary. There are a half dozen other provisions that we don't talk about as often that are in the Constitution to preserve the independence of the judiciary. For example, a Supreme Court justice cannot serve as an elector in the Electoral College.
That's fascinating. So what did you think of Justice Breyer, Stephen Breyer, who came out recently saying that packing the courts would be a bad idea? As soon as he said it, people started pressuring. They started a pressure campaign to have him retire, because, of course, they would love to have Joe Biden, nominate somebody else for the court, because it would be a slam dunk. What was his reasoning against court packing? We played a little bit of it, but your thoughts on Breyer and his position, Ginsburg and others. I mean, where are Supreme Court members, those who were on it, and those who are on it? How do they feel about this as well?
Well, one of the things that Breyer said was that that the court operates based on trust, that's a very important factor, that the court's authority depends on, quote, a trust that the court is guided by legal principle, not politics, unquote. Right. And he said that that structural alteration motivated by the perception of political influence can only feed that latter perception, further eroding that trust, and end quote. And so, I think that he's very cognizant as a sitting justice of the real handicap that would be put on the court's authority by anything that made it look like it was being motivated by politics rather than legal principles. He's very, I think, appropriately wary of these sorts of efforts to intermeddle from the outside. In terms of what other justices think, I don't think anyone else has been particularly vocal about it. I haven't seen, right. Maybe you've seen something else. I haven't seen anything recently along these lines. But I know that there's been talk of a constitutional amendment to fix the number of justices at 9. I don't think there would be anything wrong with that, but that would also require a constitutional amendment.
9 seems like a good number. You know, it's, you know, a nice odd number. You know, it seems to have worked for as many years as we've had it so far, and we'll see how all that ultimately pans out. I don't know if anything will ever come of this. There's a movement from liberal sources now to add more district courts. People are claiming, you know, hey, we have an increase in population. The increased population requires more courts. Is that an accurate statement? And how does that work? Do you think we'll see more district courts? And what other factors are at play here by adding more district courts?
I think we will see more district courts, and that is within the power of Congress to do that. And they've done it many times before. Oftentimes, they wait too long to do it for political reasons, because it's hard to get the a bipartisan agreement to do that under any president. The last time there was a huge increase in the number of judges was under Jimmy Carter. There have been some increases since then. And I think if they're serious about doing it, they should spread those out over a 6 to 8 year period so that it's less likely that all of the new judges would be appointed by any one president.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, let's take a few calls for you. We only have a few minutes. My guest today, Mark Chenoweth, if you want to join us, we're talking about court packing, or expanding the court, I should say, and you know, how that's done and whether or not it will become a reality. The number here, if you want to get in, 888-914-9149. Mark is listening in Chicago. He wants to join the conversation. Mike is listening in Chicago. Mark, he wants to join the conversation. He's got a comment for you. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Drew. How are you doing? Great program.
You
know,
thank you.
It's my opinion that you know, these progressive liberals, you know, they worship at the altar of abortion. And that could be threatened by a conservative court. Of course, it would be kicked back to the states, right? I mean, you know, the feds can only do so much. But I really think this is their fear, and at least that's what they're telling their constituents, that, you know, you have a conservative court, and they're going to take away your abortions. And I really think that's what's driving it. It's this underlying evil battle.
Yeah, Mike, thank you for bringing that up, because that's a key part, I think, of the conversation here, too. I mean, the court has been fought over in past decades, Mark, over this issue of life. We saw the appointments of or the nominations of the past president, President Trump. Your thought on how this issue of Roe v. Wade and life plays into what we're seeing in terms of where the Dems are right now and wanting to expand the number? Are they fearful that we have a conservative, number on the conservative number of justice, and that a case might come before them that could challenge Roe v. Wade? I mean, what are your thoughts on the whole pro-life, pro-choice Roe v. Wade issue in determining some of the movement that we're seeing here with this dialogue and with this action?
Well, it certainly appears to be the case that that's what the Democrat elected officials are saying and are telling their base as one of the motivations for what they're doing. But of course, Roe v. Wade came out of a Supreme Court that was dominated by Republican appointees, including Eisenhower and Nixon appointees. The Casey decision in the early 90s came from a court that I believe had 7 of the 9 justices who were appointed by Republican presidents. So we've been down this road before of people assuming that because some fraction of the justices were appointed by Republican presidents, that means that that Roe v. Wade is in jeopardy, or that pro-life sorts of decisions will be forthcoming. Haven't really seen that pan out. So that whether that's a convenient political argument or something that's a genuine possibility, I'm not sure.
So I have a moment or two left. Just finally, this commission that the president has set up, are there any people on it who are favorable to conservative principles, or is that not the case? I mean, I don't. You might not be able to answer this question. Do you know what the composition of this is? Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
I do. I've looked at it pretty closely, and there are a handful of folks on there who I think you could call right of center academics. William Bodd, from the University of Chicago Law School is generally thought of as right of center. Keith Whittington from Princeton is generally thought of as right of center. And Adam White at George Mason, I guess the Antonin Scalia School of Law and at AEI is generally thought of that way. Thomas Griffith from the D.C. Circuit, recently retired from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, was a Republican appointee to that circuit. And so you do have a few folks, but the vast majority of the folks on the committee are left liberal academics and activists, right? So you have folks who are, I should have mentioned Caleb Nelson too, from the University of Virginia School of Law. He's generally right of center, but the rest of the folks are left academics or left activists, including people like Michael Waldman of the Brennan Center at NYU, and Sherrilyn Ifill, at the president and director of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. So it's a fairly stacked panel in terms of not 100%, but certainly more than 2/3 of the folks on the committee are kind of things from a left of center or extreme left of center perspective. Wow.
Well, it will be telling to see how this pans out. Final thought here as we wrap it up. How do you think it is going to shake out in the end? And again, you can't read the future. You don't know what's in the minds of these people. But if you were a betting man, what do you think is going to come from this?
Nothing.
Really?
If I were a betting man, I would, because it takes a constitutional amendment to affect change. And I think that's going to be very difficult. I think I would be surprised to see a bipartisan recommendation come out of this commission for something short of a constitutional amendment. In other words, I don't think that you're going to see this group of folks put their stamp on some of the radical progressive ideas that have been put forward as sort of shortcut ways of packing the court.
So it's a big waste of time then, fundamentally then. That's good to know. Well, Mike, Mark, thank you very much for your time. I'm grateful for it and always enjoy having a good conversation. Mark Chenoweth is the executive director and general counsel of the new Civil Liberties Alliance. Check them out at nclalegal.org. I'd take a short pause. When we come back, more conversation straight ahead. Stay with me. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
My warning, if you will, to corporate America is to stay out of politics. It's not what you're designed for. So what I'm saying here is I think this is quite stupid to jump in the middle of a highly controversial issue, particularly when they got their facts wrong.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, that was Mitch McConnell. It's great to be here with you today. Thanks for joining me. There's a major newspaper advertisement that was signed by hundreds of CEOs and companies opposing what they're calling any discriminatory legislation. And they say, it's going to make harder for people to vote. Well, you and I have talked about voting in Georgia and just voting in general. We've talked about whether or not we need voter IDs. We've seen the influence, of major companies like Delta and Coca-Cola flexing their muscles when it comes to this issue. All of this discriminatory legislation, literally hundreds of CEOs and companies are opposing this. Okay, and it sounds good, right? Yeah, we're against discriminatory legislation. We don't want to make it harder for people to vote, right? Of course. But I have no problem with an ID. You bring your ID and it'll be simple to vote, right? This, of course, has come after a lot of backlash from the state of Georgia. They got hammered after, their new law that actually expands voting opportunities, but also requires voters to, produce a government-issued picture ID so you can vote. What is wrong with that? Again, I sit back here and I just think, okay, this is great. This is a win. Everybody should be happy. We're going to expand the voting opportunities. But, be who you say you are. And I've gone through this the other day. If I need to go into a casino, I need to show an ID that I'm able to gamble, right? If I want to buy alcohol, if I want to board a plane, if I want to drive a car, but you go through the litany of things. You need an ID. So why not have an ID to do something that can have profound impact on the nation, you know, on its legislation, on who heads up the executive branch, right? Major League Baseball, they decided to move the All-Star game to Colorado because of that law. And Colorado, it's so ironic. We've spoken about this before. They have a voter ID law in place. And yet they take it out of Atlanta, Georgia. They ship it out to Colorado. But it's not just Georgia. I'm not just talking about Georgia. Michigan Republicans, they're planning to do an end around the Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, there using a little-known process under Michigan law, so that they can get some voter reforms into place. And there are some discussions in Texas, in the Texas House, along the same line. So the response of major companies has been the same. They say, hey, watch out. Okay, watch out with what you're doing, or you might regret the actions we're going to take if you don't do it the way, you know, we want you to. And now you've got these major companies signing this ad telling states, in effect, you better watch out. Otherwise, we're going to take action against you. WXIA TV in Atlanta will tell you a little bit more about how Will Smith, and I know you're familiar with him, big actor, is doing the same thing. He's saying, I'm going to pull my movie. And we've seen a lot of, members of the film industry threatening the same thing, to move their movies out of Georgia. Will Smith's doing the same thing. Listen to this.
There was the MLB All-Star Game, and now the fallout over the voting law is trickling over into the entertainment world right here in Georgia.
The first to do it right here in a state that boasts $10 billion when it comes to the entertainment industry and the movie and TV film industry here. And as we mentioned, Will Smith and director Antoine Fuqua are halting their production of their film Emancipation in Georgia. Now, it was set to begin filming in Savannah in June, but that's not happening anymore. Now, in a joint statement, both Smith and Fuqua, who are producers on the project, in fact, Fuqua is the director, they say they felt compelled to move their production out of the state. In response to the voting law, they said in part, quote, "We cannot, in good conscience, provide economic support to a government that enacts regressive voting laws that are designed to restrict voter access."
So as we talked about, and we will talk to Dr. Jay Richards about this coming up in a second here. Voter access has been expanded. You need an ID, right? So big business, and this is really what I want to talk about, not so much voter ID or voting in general. I want to talk about how big business is flexing its muscle. And I heard somebody say, look, we don't care. We don't want you to espouse on things that are political. We just want you to sell us the product, right? Don't get involved, Delta or Coca-Cola or Nike or wherever you are. And sound off. Big business has been involved politically ever since the large corporations came into existence. The Rockefellers and Carnegies, you want a little history. And these other monopoly owners, they influenced the political process in the country. And they did it in other countries as well. That's why companies like Dole and Chiquita, they spawned, you know, the countries we know as the banana republics. But corporate influence, you know, that was done more to advance their business interests. That's what they wanted to do. So they got their tax credits for the building of a factory in a state, or maybe for protection from lawsuits for some new product that they came out with. But now what's happening are these major companies, they're basically trying to hold state legislatures hostage. And I'm not hearing a whole lot of people talk about this. Just like what happened with Georgia and Indiana. You know, when they discussed their bills that would, basically be state-level versions of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So how, first of all, why? Is it good business to get involved politically like this? How does the American public view this? How effective are they? Dr. Jay Richards joins us today. He's an assistant research professor at the Bush School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America. He's been with us many times in the past. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and the executive editor of thestream.org. You can check that out. Again, it's thestream.org. And we've talked about everything from business to fasting with him. He has come out with a number of books. I think the last book we talked to him about was Eat Fast and Feast, you know, healing your body while feeding your soul. So it's good to have him back with us. Good afternoon, Doctor. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Drew. Great to be with you again.
It's a little bit of a different topic than fasting today, but I'm glad you're here to discuss that with us. I mean, I'm just trying to get my head around the why businesses are doing this. As I said, major companies, they've been involved in politics ever since they came in on the scene, you know, all the way back to the Industrial Revolution. But today, I think it is a little bit different, you know, and maybe you can highlight that. Give us some history and also give us your view. I mean, what's different about what's going on now versus maybe what happened in the past?
Yeah, I really do think that this is different. And people will often think, well, as you said earlier, that, well, businesses have always sort of gotten involved in legislation insofar as they have particular business interests. So if a company is, you know, is doing business with another company overseas, then they're going to have an interest in not having those relationships violated, you know, from some state actor or something like that. But in the past, if you think about it, the companies were like private citizens. Private citizens have different opinions on things. And so in some ways, they balance themselves out. Just like you might have a billionaire has more influence than somebody who's not a billionaire. But billionaires didn't all think exactly alike. So they tended to balance each other out. What we have now is really the rise of, you could call it several things. You might call it a corporatocracy, or you might call it crony corporatism, but it's different from free market capitalism on the one hand, but it's also different from the socialism and communism that we had in the 20th century. With socialism, you have the government owning everything. So there are no private companies. The government's abolished private property and own everything. What we have is this kind of emergence of the large regulatory state working in collusion with the largest private corporations, all of whom are singing from the same song sheet. And that's what we had in this case. So instead of having different companies being involved, you know, across the political spectrum, we have this quite explicit collusion of basically the largest 100 or so companies in the United States of America, all signing on to a very specific left-wing partisan position that actually doesn't bear any relationship to their economic interests. So in this case, they're basically coming out against electoral reforms of the type that you mentioned in Georgia. If you look at the details of what happened in Georgia, though, it's, first of all, it's anodyne. It's like, well, you're going to need an ID if you want to have absentee balloting and elections. But also, in many cases, they've actually expanded the opportunity for voting beyond what it was before. And so not only are these companies colluding together, not only are they lining up on one side of the political spectrum, but they're actually lying about it. They're not even telling us the truth about what's actually happening in Georgia. And so, you know, I've spent most of my career worried about the overweening power of the state. Now we've got these collusions of multi-trillion companies effectively threatening small states if they try to enact perfectly just legislation. This really is a new thing.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Google, for example, and all these other companies, you said, they're all lining up on one side. They made this statement today. And correct me if I'm wrong on this. But to me, the way I read it, they're basically threatening state legislatures. Mm-hmm. Do it our way or you'll pay. What do you think will come from that? I mean, how powerful are they? Because, you know, if you are... You know, if you recognize the value of having that particular corporation in your state and they're threatening to leave or they're throwing their weight around, you know, how does that influence the American political process?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's going to distort it profoundly. I mean, this is one of these instances in which it's really quite shameless because, of course, we know they had this private call that went out some on Zoom. Some of them were at the Masters, the Augusta Golf Course, you know, these CEOs talking about these things. But it has actually been happening for the last several weeks. So if you remember the governor of South Dakota, who was supporting basically a bill that said, okay, we're going to prohibit gender transition of minors in our state. Same thing happened in South Dakota. And then in Arkansas, conservative governors that supported it initially, the legislature passed these bills, and then both governors vetoed the legislation mysteriously. Well, what happened was that private companies in those states, I'm pretty sure in South Dakota it was Amazon, And in Arkansas, it was Walmart basically called the governor and threatened them. So now, why does Walmart, first of all, care one way or the other about gender transition surgery and procedures in the state? And more strongly, why on earth would they be against such legislation? Right. And that's really the mystery. And I think it's a mix of the fact that private corporations are institutions of culture, and just like media and higher education, they've been infiltrated by these ideas. So their human resources departments and media departments have been infiltrated. And now suddenly I think these companies have decided the culture is so far over on these issues that they don't really risk their bottom line by coming out in favor of many of these radical causes.
It's so true. It's such a great point. My guest today, Dr. Jay Richards. You can join us, 888-914-9149. Doctor, let's take a few calls. Several people want to join the conversation. They've got questions for you. TJ's sure. Listening in Chicago. TJ, hi. You're on the air with Dr. Richards.
Hi, Dr. Richards. And I just wanted to thank you. I mean, you're so clear on the points of collusion and lying. I still cannot believe how they seem to have let Governor Pence, former Governor Pence, and thereafter mm-hmm. Vice President, for allowing him to cave to like the industry of PayPal and all that. I was, we're right next to Indiana, and I'm baffled how that all fell out, and really nobody has held him to the fire, because I believe that set such a powerful precedent, and upon which now you can see the waves has grown from just a few companies to now, hundreds of companies. And I really believe until people just stop participating in those types of industries altogether, like pull your money out of those types of things, eventually the bottom line does hurt, and that's what they're kind of overwhelming the states with. But I really do appreciate your honesty and candidacy about the true words are collusion and lying.
Yeah. Well, thank you, TJ. I'll let the doctor respond. Yeah,
I think that's exactly right. And what he's referring to, of course, and I love Mike Pence for so many things, but frankly, he completely dropped the ball when he was the governor of Indiana. And it was over this basically religious freedom and marriage and transgender issue. Basically defanged the legislation that had been passed by the legislature because of threats clearly from corporate interests. And in every one of these cases, these corporations, they don't want to go broke. That we can be confident of. Right. And so they're making this mental calculation that there is more to gain by coming out. Really, it could be coming out against 70% of the population of a state. So with voter ID, majorities of Democrats and Republicans around the country, and certainly in Georgia, think it's a good idea. But these companies think it's still to their benefit even to alienate maybe 70 or 75% of their actual customer base. And so you want to say, okay, why do they think that? And it must be because they think, first of all, the vocal minority on the left is just so powerful and so influential that they would rather appease those people, even if they have to anger the majority of us. And also they seem to think that there's not going to be any sort of price to pay legislatively. That is, that the politicians that would oppose those are not really in power anyway. They don't control the House. They don't control the White House. And so they don't have to worry about Mitch McConnell. And so they have made a calculation that it's worth it. And so it's really going to be up to us to correct them in that, if it's in fact not worth it. If they make enough of us mad and we're vocal enough about it, they may maybe think twice before doing this again.
Yeah, my guest, Dr. Jay Richards, if you want to join us, I have to take just a short pause if you're on hold. I'll get you on the air when I come back, okay? We'll take your calls at 888-914-9149. We're taking a look at companies getting involved in politics, actually using their influence to influence politics. That conversation and more continues right after this. The Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Get caught up on that conversation you missed by going to the Relevant Radio archives. Just select The Drew Mariani Show.
Well, thanks for joining me. If you are just getting plugged in, we're talking about Amazon and Google and hundreds of American corporations in signing a letter opposing voting limits. And the statement was organized by the former chief executive of American Express. And you know, we've got companies backing the statement like BlackRock, Netflix, General Motors, Starbucks. And I've invited today Dr. Jay Richards to stop by to join me to help us give us some perspective on the role that major corporations are now playing. And they have a lot of influence on a lot of levels in our American politics. Is it healthy for the process? Is it dangerous? And Doctor, let's pick up perhaps on that point. I can't see, you know, and I understand what they're doing, and they certainly have a right to sign a, you know, to come on one side of an issue and let their voice be be heard. I just don't know how healthy it is. Are we seeing the rise of companies that seem to think that they actually have greater power than the state does? And maybe they do. Maybe they think we're bigger, larger, wealthier. And do they, in actuality, have greater power than the state? I mean, I don't know how more obvious I can make the statement. I mean, I'm trying to get in the head of this movement. I'm saying, what do they really think? Do they think they're more powerful than the state? Do they? I mean, what's your take on that?
Yes, they do. They absolutely do. And in fact, I think in a sense they are. Now, on one hand, you could say, well, of course, private, you know, American Express doesn't have tanks. It doesn't have nuclear weapons and, you know, armed troops and things like that. Yes, of course. Nevertheless, all those tanks and missiles are actually ultimately controlled by democratically elected officials. And the electoral process is highly shaped by these powerful actors, including these private companies. And so I honestly think that at least individual states, so states like Georgia or South Dakota or Michigan, are in a sense much less powerful than these large, in some cases, trillion-dollar companies. And then add 100 of them, you're talking about the lion's share of the American economy with massive budgets to be able to lobby and support elected officials and all those sorts of things. And so in many ways, this is the danger of being a large, a very large state. There's strong economic incentive for companies, unfortunately, to get involved in this way. And then when you have the companies as institutions overrun with a particular political ideology, which is what has now happened, I mean, I think that what's happening right now is exactly what you get.
You know, I've seen that Senator Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and others are proposing a bill that would actually strip Major League Baseball of their exemptions from these antitrust laws, an exemption that the Supreme Court apparently gave them many years ago. What's the next step? Should they also look at similar legislation for Starbucks or Netflix or Google or some of these other organizations?
Well, when it comes to Major League Baseball, they actually are a monopoly. And so in that case, that was the whole point of the exemption, is the argument was that, well, unlike a private company, you really kind of need one baseball league like this. And so they got an exemption. So I think it made sense in the case of Major League Baseball. These other companies like Starbucks, it's a big company, but obviously it's not a monopoly in any meaningful sense. I do think some of the big tech companies come close to being functional monopolies. So Google and Amazon, Twitter, in some sense, Facebook. And so I think those companies, given the right kind of political environment, I think could end up in trouble with antitrust. But I honestly think the best thing to do with a lot of big tech companies, the platforms, is either to slightly amend or properly interpret so-called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which just basically gives them free permission to function as publishers by censoring whatever they want, but without having to suffer the liabilities of the publisher. So they're kind of having their cake and eating it too right now. They are free to censor without getting sued. And I think that's the thing that would actually solve the monopolies in those cases. I think with Major League Baseball, actually, an antitrust movement against them might actually work.
Let's do this. We only have a few minutes. We'll grab a few calls, and I know a lot of people have questions for you. Brian is listening in Appleton, Wisconsin, and he wants to sound off. Brian, thanks for your patience. You're on the air with Dr. Richards.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. I love your show. I really appreciate that you talk about these pertinent topics.
Thank you.
I was just wondering if it's been addressed that Ben Carson, Burgess Owens, and others have asked, why do Democrats believe that people of color are less capable of getting an ID than white people? If a Republican would make such a statement, they'd be branded as a racist.
Oh, my gosh, you're right.
Absolutely. It's really outrageous. I mean, the truth of the matter is, the average African-American, the average white, we all got IDs. I mean, every legal adult American citizen has an ID. And so if somebody's not wanting to show an ID, it's probably because they're not supposed to be voting. This implication that it's somehow discriminatory against minority voters, it really is. It's a models of essentially discrimination and racism to imply that they're incapable effectively of showing an ID. It's crazy.
It's silly. Brian, thank you for sounding off of that. It's a great point and appreciate your patience. Bernice is listening in North Central Washington. Bernice, thank you too. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make the comment that I can't go into Starbucks, I can't go into Coca-Cola and say, hey, I've got accounting experience, hire me. Oh, I'm not going to give you an ID or show you my credentials.
Right.
Just know, just trust that I'm, you know, I can do the job. That's ridiculous to even think that any company would hire you without giving them two forms of identification, your social and your driver's license. I don't understand why a company wouldn't want that, because one vote, one ID,
right.
And this is, I mean, the most important job you can do is become a senator, a representative of the state, or the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. It's the most important thing we have to do as citizens, and yet we don't have to show an identification and prove that we are a U.S. citizen.
Bernice, thank you.
It's not even, I was going to say you don't even have to be a citizen to have an identification. In California, if you're an undocumented person, you can get a driver's license.
Let's talk about this point for a moment, and thank you for your call. I think you're right on the money here. I mean, I had seen doctors, I was saying a little bit earlier, you know, somebody sent me a list of things that you actually need to have in order to be able to function without an ID. And of course, they were things right. Like you can't board an airplane, right? You can't, as she pointed out, get a job. This network's not going to hire me unless I am who I say I am and I can prove my credentials. You can't rent a car without one. You can't get a car registered. You can't board a plane. You can't buy alcohol. You can't gamble, right? And I can give you a litany of these types of things. And yet, for some reason, the thought of having to say, I am who I am, is objectionable. To her point, what is behind that? Is it strictly a political, is it a partisan issue saying, hey, we want this particular segment of the population to vote for us? The last caller talked about how offensive it is to think that somebody, just because of their skin color, can't get a license. But to your point, I mean, what is... Because this is not rational to me. I don't get it.
Not.
So explain what the impetus behind this is.
Yeah, it would be, I would say, okay, if it was something that was sort of preferentially discriminating against a particular group, the Democrats knew were more likely to vote for them, then you could say, well, that's discrimination. But that's not the case here. And so I hate to say it. I think it's just utterly cynical. I think the Democrats think that more often than not, they benefit from voter fraud, and they don't want the election integrity that makes voter fraud more difficult. I honestly think that's exactly what's happening. That's why Democrat machine politics in places like Chicago and Detroit, which have been controlled by a single party, are utterly corrupt. They depend upon that. And so that's what's so disturbing about this, is that all these CEOs, it's not just they would sign on to something that's I disagree with politically, it's that they're actually signing on against election integrity for voter corruption, and they're doing it quite cynically and assuming that people don't understand that, look, all we're talking about is IDs and things like that in Georgia. They already have that in states like Delaware, which is where Joe Biden is from. This really is crazy.
Hey, well, Dr. Frizzell, thank you for your time. I always, always enjoy talking with you. You're always so clear and so rational, and it's good whether we're talking about the power of fasting or politics. It's fun. Your books, if people want to get connected to you, I know the stream.org is a wonderful resource. I hope people will check you out there, but how can they get your books if they want to pick them up?
I mean, we're talking about Amazon, but you can get it at Amazon. You can get the Price of Panic actually at Regnery, and follow me on Twitter at Dr. J. Richards.
All right, Dr. J. Richards. All right, sounds great. Hey, Doctor, thank you. Enjoy your day and grateful again for your time.
Thanks, Drew.
All right, it's Dr. J. Richards. As I said, he is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, executive director of the stream.org, and the author of a number of those great books. I only have about a moment left. I want to let you know that Cale Clark is coming up next, and the conversation sounds like it's going to be a good one. Do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? All right, do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? He'll dive into that, and he says it's the five-year anniversary since Kobe's last NBA game. That's amazing. Where is the time gone, right? That is unbelievable. So stay tuned. Kale's coming up in just a moment and get a chance to listen to him. Also, I just want to share a quick email. I just was going through the show email during the show here, and Diane in Austin writes to me, and she says, oh, my goodness, I finally had an opportunity to log in, but I see I missed the deadline for Drew's book. She says, I'm sick, and I am heartbroken. Will this book be for sale anytime? Thank you and God bless. You know, I can't answer that. I just want to let everybody know I had said as of Divine Mercy Sunday, I think that would probably be the last day the book is going to be available. So I don't expect the book to go on sale. I really don't. I mean, we initially, when we did this particular book, wanted to give it away. Maybe that will happen at some point in the future, and maybe there are some copies that still remain. I'll speak to management. I'll find out what's going on. If there's a way for you to get it, I'll try to let everybody know. But my gratitude to everybody who's already said, hey, I want your book. And again, I've talked about it probably 3 solid weeks. You know, we talked about it a lot. So if you have it and you read it, like I said, share it with others. But above all, live the message of mercy, okay? And I think that book will certainly bless you. And I'm grateful for everyone who said yes to it. Hey, I'm going to be back again tomorrow. I'm out of time for the day. I wish I could hang out with you another 3 hours. We've got a lot. Do you know what tomorrow's anniversary is? It's the anniversary of the Notre Dame fire. That was 2 years ago tomorrow. We're going to go live to France for an update on that. Ken Starr might be stopping by. We want to talk to him. There's a lot happening right now with the Supreme Court, with religious liberty in our country. And Joe Biden is proposing to give money to migrants not to come to our border. Will that work? Well, we'll look at all that. We'll pray the chaplet and more. Until tomorrow, have a great day and may God bless you.